The first Monday of the month, we look skyward to see what the May skies are going to look like. And joining us is the man who knows all about it. He's the manager of the University of Michigan Planetarium. Oh, he looks bedecked in a beautiful bow tie today. He wears a bow tie every day. And we love talking with Buddy Stark. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
It's always illuminating, to have you on our show here. What are the, is it Aquarids?
Yeah, Aquarids is usually how it's pronounced. Yeah, so that's one of the meteor showers that's currently going on, and it'll be sort of all this week. It's sort of a spread out, sort of a long, slow burn meteor shower. The only downside to the Aquarids is, at least this year, is that you have to stay up quite late, or really, more realistically, wake up pretty early. They don't really start showing up in the sky until about 3 a.m. here in Michigan. Other parts of the world have it better for this meteor shower, but here you have to wait pretty late, or you just wake up, you know, if you're an early morning person.
Isn't that because the moon is setting at that time?
So that definitely helps. So we also right now are in sort of this gibbous moon phase, and as we've talked about before, when the moon is really bright in the sky, it gets in the way of seeing things like mm-hmm. meteors. And so that's part of it. The other part is that something called the radiant point, which is the point of the sky where the meteor showers appear to be coming out of, right? Like that's the direction that they seem to be coming from, has to be above your horizon in order for you to start seeing these meteors. And so the point at which that part of the sky will rise into the sky in Michigan is about 3 o'clock in the morning or so.
And these particular meteor showers actually originate from the, is it Halley's Comet?
Yeah, Halley's Comet. Yeah. The most meteor showers come from a comet of some kind.
Oh, okay.
And there's really three or four comets that are fairly common for our meteor showers, and this one is Halley's Comet.
So does it break off? What is that?
Yeah, so as comets go around the sun, especially as they get near the sun, which as far as comets are concerned, the Earth is quite near the sun, they warm up, right? And the makeup of a comet is, we often call it a dirty snowball. So there's dirt and there's rocks, but there's also a lot of like water, ice, and other things that do not do well with heat. So as it gets close to the sun, it sublimates, which is going right from a solid to a gas.
Hmm.
And as it does, pieces of that comet will fall off because things are melting and things are sublimating. And so then it leaves behind this trail of sort of junk, of little pieces of rock and dust out in space. And then later on, the Earth comes through and we smash into that trail of stuff that was left behind by the comet. And so then that's what we see. We're smashing into the leftover bits.
So Halley's Comet, it only comes around once every,
76 years or so.
76 years.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not going to see it again, I think, until 2060-something?
Yeah, I was born at a very poor time for Halley's Comet. Yeah, it came around when I was like 7, and again, it's going to be like when I'm like 87 or something.
At least you'll be around, hopefully.
Yeah. Well, one can hope, yeah.
But I think what's fascinating about these meteors, we're actually seeing a piece of that comet, you know.
In our sky,
yeah. Yeah, exactly, mm-hmm. even though it is infrequently going by.
Yeah, well, and at this point, it left that debris quite some time ago,
mm-hmm.
And now we see that debris every year because the Earth hits that same debris
right.
over and over again.
Right. Mm-hmm. What ultimately happens to that debris?
Well, you give it enough time, and we're talking about well beyond human life scales here, you give it enough time and the Earth will eventually have sort of cleared that area. Right,
mm-hmm.
It will have ran into just about everything that's there, and so over time, that meteor shower is going to slowly get, you know, worse and worse from our point of view, less and less stuff to hit.
Fascinating. All right, something else that's happening this month, buddy. Mars will be near something called the Beehive Cluster. What is that?
Yeah, so the sky is filled with these things called Messier objects, named after a French astronomer, Messier, who cataloged them. And so M44, the Beehive Cluster, is one of the easier things to see in the sky. Actually, if you're in somewhere very, very dark, so make sure you got a new moon, you don't even have to have telescopes or binoculars. It's actually naked eye visible. But it's much easier to spot if you have a decent pair of binoculars or a small telescope. And what it is it's called an open cluster of stars. So it's a part of the sky where there are, in this case, about 1,000 stars in a very small section of the sky. So when you point a telescope at it, you suddenly see, way more stars than you would expect in a small space of the sky most of the time. And so right now, because Mars is near it, it can help people find it in the sky. Because you can go outside, Mars is pretty easy. It's in the west. It's this bright red thing. And then you know nearby, if you start pointing a telescope in that area, you're likely to see this really tight pack
wow.
of stars.
And about when?
So it's really all month. This week actually is the best time because Mars does sort of meander, right? Mm-hmm. This is how planets get the name planet. That means a wandering star in Greek.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, because that's what they look like, right? They look like stars that kind of move around as they orbit the sun. So this week is when it's really close to the Beehive Cluster. And you'll want to go out really just because it's in the west. So you'll want to go out just after sunset. Mm-hmm. So that nowadays that's sort of like 9:30, right? Because it's starting to get dark pretty late.
So are there new stars being formed all the time, or are there a finite number of stars already there?
Oh, no, there are. So in the case of the Beehive Cluster, they are what they are. There's no formation happening there. But other parts of the sky, other parts of the universe, there are new stars being made as we speak right now. So an example of that is the Orion Nebula, which is a huge cloud of gas. This is more of a wintertime thing. But as that cloud collapses, the pressure gets high enough that new baby stars are made inside of that cloud of gas and dust. So that does happen.
Back to the moon for a moment. Why is it when you look at the moon sometimes, it looks like it's humongous, like you could reach up and touch it.
Yeah.
And it's really bright and different colors.
Right.
Why is that?
Yeah, so the different colors have to do mostly, unless we're talking about a lunar eclipse, which is when it hits the Earth's shadow and turns red. But the other different colors that you see are predominantly from your own atmosphere. So the dust and the material that the moonlight has to pass through can color it a little bit. And so sometimes you get a yellowish moon
or
orangey.
Orangish.
Yeah. But in terms of the size, that's actually a really interesting thing that you bring up. It's an optical illusion. And there are a couple of different – it's not particularly well understood, but there's a couple of different explanations for it. The moon is actually much – even when it's not – sometimes you look up and it's huge. Other times you look up and you're like, yeah, that's the moon. Even when you are looking at the moon and you don't feel like it's that big, you still overestimate it. And the thing I ask people to do is to go outside and find the moon and put their thumb at arm's length.
Mm-hmm.
And what they'll find is that their thumb can pretty easily cover
even
a full moon, just your thumb.
Right.
And that's really surprising to a lot of people. One of the explanations for this is that especially when it's low in the sky, because this tends to be when it looks biggest.
Yeah, it's right when it's over the horizon.
Yeah, and it looks like this huge thing all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm.
Even at that point, you can still cover it with your thumb. So give that a try. So,
you're kidding me.
Yeah, no, it's always true. You can always cover it with your thumb. Right?
Even when it looks humongous.
So we think what's happening there is that your brain knows how big trees are. They're big things, right? They're huge. And you know how big buildings are. I mean, way bigger than I am.
We don't know how big the moon is.
Well, and so what happens when the moon gets down near the horizon, you start comparing it to a building that's way off in the distance.
Right.
Or a tree that's way off. And the tree looks tiny because it's way off in the distance.
Oh.
So the moon, by comparison, looks huge because you know how big trees are.
Right.
And the moon's even bigger than that little tree that's off there. So it must be gigantic. And your brain kind of tricks you into thinking, oh, it's gigantic right now.
Wow.
But the apparent size of it hasn't really changed.
And the other phenomenon on that is, why is it when you seem to be in the same spot, the moon seems to be moving very quickly past you? Or you move somewhere, maybe that's what it is, and all of a sudden the moon is there too.
Sure. So I think what you're getting at there is something called parallax motion, which is that, you know, as you move, most things around you seem to move in a way, right? So like as you're driving down the road, trees kind of pass by,
mm-hmm.
right? Trees, there was a tree there a while ago, but now I'm 3 miles down the road.
But the tree's not moving.
Right. But to you, it looks like it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're moving. And so it looks, so it's gone past you as far as you're concerned.
Oh.
But the moon, because it's so much further away, doesn't do that. It just kind of sits right there.
Uh-huh.
And so that can create some weird effect where you see a tree moving because it's quite a bit closer to you than the moon is, but the moon itself doesn't. And so you can get this sort of weird parallax.
Parallax.
Yeah. Parallax is the name for
That's a new word for me.
Yeah.
Buddy Stark with us from the University of Michigan Planetarium. He comes on board each month here to tell us what's going to be in the skies above us. There also was an exciting development this past month, something with an exoplanet.
Yes. So I got a little bit of news. You might have heard that there was a planet that was actually found quite a while ago, but they found what's called a possible biosignature, which is a fancy term for something that might point to life on the planet, right? It's not a guarantee, and the team that has done this has been very clear that they are not making any bold claims that it's definitely there. But what we do know is that there in the atmosphere of this planet, there's something called dimethyl sulfide. And dimethyl sulfide is a chemical that on Earth only shows up by processes of bacteria or phytoplankton in the ocean. and it doesn't last very long. So if there's nothing making more of it, it kind of dissipates and it reacts with other things and it doesn't hang out in the atmosphere.
What makes it, though?
So it's when these things, in some cases, it's their part of their photosynthesis process. So things like phytoplankton in the ocean.
You're talking about living things.
Yes. Yeah. I'm talking about, living things. Yeah. Bacteria. We're talking about small living things, but living things.
We didn't think that it was there before, or?
Well, we hadn't found it yet. The scientists with these big telescopes are looking for very specific molecules that the only way we know to produce them naturally are from life. So if we find them elsewhere, we take that as a possible sign of life there. And they found one of those around this planet in concentrations that are about 20 times higher than concentrations on the Earth.
And what does the term exoplanet mean?
Exoplanet is the term that we assign to a planet that's going around some other star. So in the last 30 years or so, we've started finding planets going, when you go out at nighttime, you look up at the stars, what you're doing is looking out into a universe full of other suns, mm-hmm. right? There's no difference between our sun and other stars, except that the sun's much closer. It's the one we're going around. So those other stars also have planets. And so we call planets going around other stars exoplanets.
Okay. So, of course, this leads to the question of, is there life out there?
Right. Well, and that's sort of what's gotten this so much buzz, is that this is evidence that there might be. It is possible that there is a way to make this chemical that doesn't require life, that we're just not aware of. But on Earth, the only natural way to do it is through those biological processes.
Yet you don't believe that extraterrestrial beings have visited the Earth.
No, yeah, we were talking earlier. I have a hard time. I was telling Lucy that if aliens are intelligent enough to traverse space, which we are not capable of at those distances yet, we haven't been remotely close to the next star. So they would have to be quite a bit more advanced than we are to get here. And so it seems strange that they would be that advanced and then be really cagey and coy about like announcing themselves. We wouldn't pose any real threat to them. So it would be strange.
So maybe the way to look at this is if other planets, exoplanets, whatever they are, can sustain some form of life, we may be able to visit those places one day.
I mean, we are well away. So this particular planet is a little over 100 light years away, which means that even our communication, if we were to send this radio signal that we're broadcasting to them, even the signal would take 100 years to get there.
So no one would live long enough to go there.
Not one. You'd have to have several generations on a spaceship to try and get there for sure.
Wouldn't that be weird if you went up knowing that you were going to make other generations who never had been on Earth, who were designed just to go to that planet one day.
That would be a strange life.
It would be. Yeah. Great talking with you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up at the University of Michigan Planetarium, a new movie will be debuting.
Yes, there's a brand new film that just came out. We're very excited. In July this year, we're unveiling T-Rex, and the name kind of gives it away. It's all about the tyrant king of dinosaurs, so it's very good.
Ooh, neat.
Yeah, it's very exciting.
Right. And just Google University of Michigan Planetarium, and it'll come up with all the great information. It's a wonderful place for you to visit with your family and enjoy those planetarium times as well. When do you host those?
Yeah, so right now it's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, 12, 1, 2, and 3 p.m. In the summertime, we do go to Tuesday through Sunday. So when we unveil T-Rex, you can come any day but Monday, and you'll see the show.
And this isn't just any planetarium. This is really well-equipped and really cool.
Oh, yeah. It is
from
a very...
From the seating to everything.
Yeah, the Cadillac of seats. Yeah, we brag about those seats a lot. They are very comfortable. Yeah, you won't complain about those.
Technological phenomenon at the University of Michigan Planetarium here in Ann Arbor. Buddy Stark is the manager. Great talking with you. See you next month.
Yep. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Ann Arbor's Talk Station, 1290 WLBY.